The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today we bring you journalist and DePaul University graduate, James Stewart.
Now, many of you know that DePaul University has a long and distinguished tradition in journalism and continues to graduate just an enormous number of outstanding professionals. A sampling would include names like Ken Hogate and Barney Kilgore, both editors of the Wall Street Journal, Don Maxwell, editor of the Chicago Tribune, and of course, here in Indianapolis, our own Eugene S. Pulliam, publisher of legendary publisher of both The Star and The News. Today, we welcome to our podium another prominent journalist from DePaul, James Stewart, now the Bloomberg Professor of Business and Economic Journalism at Columbia University. He's also a graduate of the Harvard Law School and a member of the New York Bar. You may remember Jim as the 1988 winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his Wall Street Journal articles about the 87 upheaval based on insider trading in the stock market. That led him to later write a nonfiction bestseller titled Den of Thieves, describing the criminal conduct of Ivan Boesky and junk bond king Michael Milken. Last year, he produced another outstanding book titled Tangled Webs, How False Statements Are Undermining America, from Martha Stewart to Bernie Madoff. Jim continues today to be a contributor to The New Yorker magazine and a columnist for The New York Times, and has served on the board of trustees for many years of his alma mater in Greencastle, where he's the past president of the board. I don't know about you, but I'm consider that a very impressive resume, and I'm really delighted to hear what he has to say. So without further ado, please welcome our luncheon speaker, Jim Stewart.
Thank you, Jamie, and thanks all of you for coming out today. What an impressive crowd. I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and it really is, as you can tell from my resume, it's a homecoming of sorts. I wasn't born in Indiana, but I feel like a Hoosier after going to school here 4 years and then being back so many times to stay connected with DePaul. And there are many DePaul people here and friends in the audience. I have to especially thank Kathy and Al Hubbard, who hosted me here last night and I've become very good friends with, and Dr. Casey, who's the current president of DePaul. And I have to say, I think speaking on behalf of everyone who's gone to DePaul, there's never been a more exciting time there. And I think Indiana especially can be very proud of the fact that DePaul is really on the cutting edge of showing what a liberal arts college can do in today's world. So thanks to DePaul for that. Given that I'm going to talk a lot about lying, I have to be very careful what I say here today, because my sister also is in the audience. So she's in a position to fact check virtually anything I'm going to tell you. And, you know, many people have asked how I got interested in this subject and ethics in generally. And I think a lot of it does go to my formative years growing up in the Midwest. When I was in the second grade, I came back from the lunchroom one day and there was a hubbub at the front of the room. And this young girl said, everybody was buzzing around saying, oh, my God, she had a dime stolen during the lunch break. And I don't know what came over me, but I guess I was jealous of the attention she was getting. I just blurted out, well, I had a dollar stolen while I was at lunch. So it worked only too well. She was dropped like a hot potato. Everybody rushed to me and said, oh, a dollar, what were you doing with a dollar? You haven't even had a dollar in those days. At which point the teacher walks in, and I'm not saying, can we just tone this down a little bit? And she said, well, what were you doing with the dollar? And my mind is now racing, and I said, my mother gave it to me to do the grocery shopping after school. At which point she grabbed me by the collar, marched me to the principal's office, where I sat down, and in the presence of the principal and the teacher, the principal called my mother, who of course denied the entire story, and I was sent home. And the next day I had to stand up before the class and acknowledge publicly that I had fabricated the entire story. It may not seem like such a big deal, but obviously it has stuck in my mind all of these years. Well, the kinds of lies I've been examining in my career as a journalist are much more serious than that, I'm sorry to say. And this theme kind of gelled as I was continuing to write after Den of Thieves about the corporate scandals that swept the country in the 80s into the 90s, political scandals, cases like Tyco International, Adelphia, Enron, very famously, WorldCom, all of which involve not just mid-level or low-level employees, lying, but the highest level people in the company, the chief executives, the chief financial officers, who were lying, and in many cases, they were lying in context where it's not just wrong to lie, it is a crime to lie, or it is consists of securities fraud. And millions of investors relying on these false statements invested their money and lost billions of dollars. And unlike Den of Thieves, where there was a kind of coherent conspiracy that brought these people together to commit these crimes, I didn't see many obvious links until one day kind of like a light bulb went off to me. And it was, well, there was just an astounding willingness on all of their parts to lie at that very high level. And what attracted me to the issue was that they were so prominent and successful. These are people who are role models in their communities. They're incredibly wealthy with enormous take-home compensation packages, stock options. They're respected members of their community. They're role models for young people. And I thought, I would think of all the people in America, they would be the least likely to lie because they have so much to lose. And in many cases, the consequences of telling the truth wouldn't even have been so significant, and certainly not nearly as significant as what resulted from the lies. So I was wondering, well, what made them do that? And then once I was kind of sensitized to the whole idea of lying in high places, it was cropping up everywhere. I think probably the most egregious example came with the example of John Edwards, a vice presidential candidate, a senator, someone, it has subsequently been demonstrated, induced his top aide to file a false affidavit under oath saying that the aide was the father of John Edwards' illegitimate child. Now, people ask me why I don't write fiction. Could you make up a story like that? And by the way, he was acquitted on these bizarre charges involving campaign finance funds, and I keep wondering, why didn't they charge him with a conspiracy to lie under oath, which I feel could have walked into court and proven in a matter of hours, but nevertheless, they didn't go that route. I also, in my book, ended up writing about the political sphere in the case of Scooter Libby, who was a top aide to former Vice President Cheney, to show that I'm completely nonpartisan when it comes to ethical violations in high places. In the world of sports, where Barry Bonds is the reigning all-time home run champion, but obviously he was convicted in federal court of lying about the use of steroids. Bernie Madoff, I don't need to remind you, the biggest Ponzi scheme operator of all time, whose entire life was one big lie. And Martha Stewart, who was convicted of false statements for allegedly engaging in an insider trading scheme. And I've chose these cases not only because I think it's amply demonstrated that they did lie, but to explore this question of why would people like this, of all people, major role models in this country, why would they do that? And that's really what embarked me on this quest. I want to tell you a little bit about each of these to show some of the dimensions of the case. I'm not going to focus so much on the facts, which were, you know, generally covered in the media, but maybe some of the lesser-known elements of this story that I think reveal something more deeply about why people lie. And I'm sure everyone sitting in this room is saying, well, okay, maybe Barry Bonds lied or somebody in the administration lied, but I would never lie under oath. And I think when you hear these stories, you might question just what it might take and the kinds of pressure that people, even at fairly high levels, come under to make false statements even when they know that's a crime and the consequences of that. Now, the Martha Stewart story, to briefly refresh your memory, she was going on a vacation the day after Christmas. She was en route when she got a call from her stockbroker. Her stockbroker had just learned that the chief executive of biotech company InClone Systems was trying to dump all of his shares the day before the FDA was going to issue a ruling on whether their only drug was going to be approved or not. It doesn't take a genius to figure out, the FDA is going to make a ruling, the CEO is dumping all of his shares. Is that likely to be a good ruling coming out of the FDA? I don't think so. So she stopped en route in San Antonio on the way to Mexico. She put in a call. There was a message that was left by her broker that said, quote, Peter Bukanovic, the name of the broker, thinks ImClone is going to trade downwards. So Martha Stewart called in. Peter Bukanovic was on vacation, but his young assistant, Doug Fanuel, answered the phone. He said, Peter told me to tell you that the head of ImClone is trying to dump all his shares, and so are all of his family members. Martha Stewart thought about that for about 2 seconds, and she said, sell. Sell it all. She owned ImClone shares. She resumed her trip to Mexico, and when she got there with her best friend, a real estate broker from Connecticut, they were lounging on the terrace, and we know from later testimony, Martha Stewart said, isn't it nice to have brokers who tell you things? Now, there the story might have ended, except the next day they found the trading. Routine monitoring showed a lot of suspicious trading at MClone before the bad news came out. And immediately, internal monitors at Merrill Lynch, her firm, and at the SEC started asking questions. So they asked the three key participants, Martha herself, Peter Bukanovic, and Doug Fanuel. So right off the bat, let me tell you, people in high places are not especially good lawyers. Martha Stewart said, I called Peter Bukanovic. He took the order. We had agreed that I would sell for tax losses, and we sold. Peter Bukanovic told the same story, except he said, I wasn't there. She called my assistant, and it was a prearranged agreement to sell because of tax loss. He had told that story to Doug. Doug, who was sitting there saying, wait a minute, was this about tax loss? Repeated the story. Well, there was only one problem with this. Martha Stewart had a big gain on her MClone shares. And I don't think I need to tell you that when you engage in tax loss selling, you want a loss. So here we have all these officials at Merrill Lynch who are now getting inconsistent stories about who actually took the order and the fact that it's tax loss selling when there was no loss. No one asked any questions. Now it's time to go to the SEC. Before they go to testify, Peter Bukanovic calls Doug, the assistant, again and says, well, you know, the reason we sold is because Martha Stewart had a prearranged order to sell at $60 a share. And Doug said, well, wait a minute. What happened to the tax loss selling? And Doug said, no, she had a prearranged agreement to sell at 60. Obviously, they decided to change the story. So they went and testified. All three of them said it was a prearranged order at $60 a share. No one inside Merrill Lynch seemed to think this was the least bit peculiar. Are there any issues about this? So the testimony was all given. It was all under oath. As we now later learned, it was all false. Now, here's another interesting element of this particular story. This investigation took months. And there were ample opportunities that any one of them could have changed the story, and if they'd all done it together and come forward, we would never would probably have even heard of this case. They didn't really care about Martha Stewart when they were looking at insider trading at MClone. Nevertheless, they went to testify, and before Martha made her appearance before the U.S. Attorney's Office in Lower Manhattan, her lawyers said, we'd like to review your email messages from the week that you were making this trip. So she had her secretary, a woman named Ann Armstrong, pull these up on the computer screen. And she went down the list. And on that day, December 26th, there was the computer message that Peter Bukanovic had called and left the message, MClone is going to trade downwards. Martha Stewart came out of her office. She went behind her secretary. She grabbed the computer mouse out of her secretary's hands, and she erased MClone is going to trade downwards. And she wrote instead, R-E MClone. Then she went back to her office. Now, after sitting there for a few minutes, the secretary, by the way, is now in shock, thinking, oh, my God, what have we done now? And so Martha Stewart called her son-in-law, who happened to be a lawyer. He said, oh, my God, get it back. Get that message back. That's obstruction of justice. You know, never do anything like that. So Martha Stewart came back out and said to the secretary, we'll get it back. The secretary fiddled around with the computer. She couldn't get it back. Nobody knew how to get it back. Martha didn't know how to get it back. It was gone. So that was a Friday. Friday afternoon, Saturday, the secretary was now so worried that she wrote a letter to herself explaining what had happened. And she put one copy in the safe. She put another copy and locked it in her drawer. And she sent another copy to Martha Stewart's lawyers at the very eminent and highly compensated firm of Wachtell Lipton. So all weekend, they spent trying to get the message back. Monday, they still didn't have it. And it was time to go, and Martha Stewart was going to testify. So one of the questions was, not surprisingly, did you get a message from your stockbroker on that day? And Martha Stewart said, I don't recall. Now remember, this is the message. She has just spent all weekend trying to get back after she erased it. Now, again, she has some of those highly paid lawyers in the country who are sitting there when this has happened, and they have been trying to get the message back. Don't you think this would have been time for the proverbial bathroom break, stepping out into the hall, saying, oh, wait a minute here, Martha, don't you think you do remember this? But no. The lawyers just sat there, let her give this testimony. And I think one of the messages here is none of these, first of all, the lie didn't happen once. It happened many times under increasingly serious circumstances. And Martha wasn't the only one involved in this lie. There were the Merrill Lynch compliance people who let her get away with it. Her stockbroker went along with it. The assistant got pressured to do it. And finally, even her own very highly paid lawyer sat there while she committed a brazen false statement. And I have to say, in the annals of false statement convictions and perjury prosecutions, I believe Martha Stewart is the only example in history of someone who was convicted of lying for saying, quote, "I don't remember," unquote. Because you can forget almost anything, but not the erased message. And by the way, this whole case collapsed when Doug Fanuel, the young assistant, was finally called before the grand jury and was told, "You're going to have to put your hand up, take the oath on the Bible, and promise to tell the truth and nothing but the truth." And he looked himself in the mirror the night before and said to himself, "I can't do that. I wasn't raised in that kind of family. That's not what I learned in school. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in a citizen's obligation to tell the truth." And he did tell the truth at great personal cost to himself, which ultimately brought this whole house of cards down. Now, the Madoff case, as I said, he was one of the most brazen liars in history. His whole life was a lie. And I figured, gosh, he got away with this for like 20 years. He must be a brilliant, brilliant liar. So I read his testimony, his statements that he gave that he got away with it for so many years, because he was investigated by the SEC on 4 different occasions, and they didn't find anything untoward. Now, you may know that when they looked into Bernie Madoff's fictitious trading, the records of it, it was amazing because he essentially never had a losing trade. He always bought low and sold high. When the market was going to go down, he's out of the market. When the market's going up, he's 100% in the market. You had to do something like that in order to achieve the consistent returns that he generated. So he seemed like he had solved the investor's greatest dilemma, which, how do you market time? How do you know when the market is going up and when is it going down? The SEC, seeing this pattern, was, of course, curious to know what his secret was. So that was one of the first questions they asked in the investigation. And I saw the transcript of this, and so Madoff answers. He said, it's kind of like if you have a blender and you put oranges and carrots in it, it comes out one way. And if you put apples and pears, it comes out a different way. And then pretty soon he's like, it's like some kind of like cookbook recipe or something like that. And the SEC lawyers just kind of like, you know, nodded and said, "Oh, okay, right, Bernie." And they went on to the next question. It's the most ludicrous answer I've ever seen. But somehow he managed to do that. Now, at another occasion, he had big clients. Many of them, all they did was funnel money to him to invest, and then they would take 20% of the profits and charge their clients 2% of the fees. One of these was a big firm called Fairfield Greenwich, which was nominally a hedge fund based in Greenwich, Connecticut. So for years, the SEC was afraid to contact his clients. They were afraid that he might somehow retaliate, a fear, by the way, not completely unreasonable, when in each investigation Bernie Madoff warned the SEC investigators that it was quite possible that he himself was going to be the next SEC chairman, which of course didn't turn out to be true, but was in fact plausible. So they were very nervous about going to clients and that there might be repercussions. But finally they did, and they went to Fairfield Greenwich, and they said, "We'd like to question you about his strategy and his trading. And by the way, would you please keep this investigation in confidence?" So what did the Fairfield Greenwich people do within a matter of minutes of hanging up the phone from the SEC? They called Bernie Madoff, and they said, "Well, you know, Bernie, we think you ought to know the SEC is sniffing around here." So Madoff said, "Okay, we'll have a conference call tomorrow. So Madoff called them back, and his very first words were, "Now, this conversation never happened." Now, the reason I know those are his first words is that Fairfield Madoff had a system, a recording system, and because Madoff talked so fast and they had trouble writing down notes, they put the recording system on automatically. So there is a recording of this remarkable conversation, a copy of which I was able to get. And he starts by saying, "This conversation never happened." Now, on the Fairfield Greenwich side were the chief risk officer and the general counsel, a lawyer, who were sitting in. And you would, I can't imagine that someone would begin a conversation by saying, "Now, this never happened," when you know this person is under investigation by the SEC and you are going to be asked to testify, that you're now supposedly supposed to agree that this never happened. Isn't that a red flag? So they were talking about what his strategy was, and it was he called it the split strike conversion strategy, which sounds like a baseball pitching strategy, but it's really very simple. You would buy a basket of stocks. You would own the stocks, you'd be long the stocks, and then you would buy put options, or you would buy options that would gain in price if the market went down. It was a simple hedging strategy. And like all hedging strategies, it will work up to a point, but it doesn't necessarily yield any profits because the costs of hedging are so high. But the SEC had asked Madoff if he traded in options, and he had said, no, options are not part of the strategy, because if he had traded in options, there might have been a record of that, and he didn't want the SEC asking for the record. So he said, no, I don't trade in options. It's part of the strategy. So on this call, he says to Fairfield Greenwich, he said, well, I don't trade in options. They said, wait a minute. We thought options was the key to the split strike conversion strategy. And they said, in fact, we have a brochure right here that you just gave us that said options are the key part of my winning strategy. And he said, well, that brochure is out of date. They said, wait a minute. We just got it a few days ago. But anyway, they're sort of nodding and agreeing and going along with all of this. And then when the SEC calls finally to actually take their testimony, what do they say? Oh, no, options are not part of his strategy. They went chapter and verse, essentially Madoff dictated to them what to say, much of it a lie, all of it a lie, and they went right along with the script and told the SEC that, without disclosing that they, in fact, had tipped off Madoff to the investigation and had basically decided to say whatever he told them to say, despite what they knew the truth to be. Now, the SEC was suspicious. I mean, what they said was so exactly the same as what Madoff had just testified to that they were suspicious. But they, unfortunately, as we know, were not suspicious enough. When that investigation was underway, Madoff purported to have about $20 billion under management. When the House of Cards came crashing down, he had $60 billion. That cost investors an additional $40 billion in losses. I just want to mention that I've given as an example of people that I would call enablers. These are people who surround the subjects of these investigations, and when you look at what actually happens, made it possible. If any of these people had stood up and said, wait a minute, this is an obvious lie, you're actually insulting my intelligence, expecting me to go along with it, it would have been stopped in its tracks. And there are some examples I've run into of people who do the right thing, and I just want to mention one of them. It came in the Scooter Libby case. Scooter Libby, I think, out of a sense of loyalty to the vice president, lied repeatedly and lied in a very clumsy way in an attempt to deflect blame for who was the one who actually put in motion the events that outed Valerie Plame as a CIA agent. There was enormous controversy about all this after Bob Novak wrote in his Washington Post column that she was, in fact, a covert CIA agent. And when you want to look to see where that really started, all the trails lead back to the vice president's office. Vice President Cheney was very angry at her husband, and what I think was a ridiculously misguided PR strategy, thought they could impugn the husband by pointing out that her wife was a CIA agent. But what I found most interesting was not so much Libby in this case, but the real source of the Novak column, who, among others, was Karl Rove inside the White House. And Karl Rove, to his credit, was represented by a very good Washington lawyer named Michael Luskin, and he did testify that, yes, he didn't mean to, but he had inadvertently confirmed to Bob Novak that Valerie Plame was a covert CIA agent. But he also insisted that he had never discussed it with anyone else, and he had told no other reporters of the identity of this person. Unfortunately for him, as his emails got examined and correspondence came forward, and as some other journalists were required to testify, a Time magazine reporter revealed notes that indicated that he, in fact, Karl Rove, had also disclosed the identity of the agent to this Time magazine reporter. And this posed a real dilemma. I mean, I think most of these other lawyers probably would have just said, oh, we'll just let that one slip under the rug. Karl Luskin actually immediately went to the special counsel and said, I know he testified to the grand jury. They never said it to anyone else, but we've now found this. It's refreshed his memory. We want him to come back before the grand jury. Karl Rove came back. He said, I'm really sorry. I think I forgot. I didn't remember at the time. I was confused. I now see this document that reminds me, and yes, I did disclose to a Time magazine reporter. And he came very close to getting indicted, both as the source of the leak to Bob Novak and for not immediately disclosing this when he first testified to the grand jury. But I think because of the refreshing candor and honesty of his lawyer, he was not charged, which allows him to continue to be a pundit on Fox News. So that, I think, is a great example of what happens when actually people do tell the truth. The results are not as bad. Finally, I will just briefly mention Barry Bonds, the home run king, who I think is a very important character. Some people have said, oh, who cares about Barry Bonds? He's just an athlete. I think an athlete of his stature plays an enormous role in this country, is a role model for millions of young people, and what he does has enormous repercussions. But again, Barry Bonds did not do this in a vacuum. He was asked if he had used steroids before the grand jury. He said absolutely not, never used them, didn't know what they were, never took them. I'm not going to spend much time on this, because if you see a picture of Barry Bonds when he was playing as a Pittsburgh Pirate and then you look 10 years later and he's a San Francisco Giant, you can't even tell it's the same person. It is obvious that he has been taking a lot of steroids, and there was a tremendous amount of testimony to that effect. But this investigation of him ended up spanning 8 years and cost hundreds of millions of dollars to prosecute, investigate. And there was one person that could have ended it in 2 minutes, and that was his trainer, Greg Anderson, who there was an enormous amount of testimony, supplied the steroids, got the steroids, injected the steroids, applied creams to his skin. Barry Bonds had his own separate wing of the dressing room at the Giants, where only he and his trainer and a few other loyal people were allowed to go. None of the other players could go in there. Do you think it ever seemed peculiar to Giants management that he had to have this his own special wing, that the team doctor was never allowed to examine him? I mean, the clues were everywhere, and people closed their eyes to them. But Greg Anderson, again, was called before the grand jury. He was asked to testify about it. Initially, he lied and said, no, I never gave him steroids, never used them. They confronted him with evidence to the contrary. He said, well, I'm not testifying. I'm not saying anymore. He was put in jail for contempt of court for refusing to testify 3 different times while the grand jury was sitting, and he would never actually honestly answer the question. And when he finally got out of jail the last time, his lawyer gave a statement to the press and said, the only thing worse in America than being a cheat is being a snitch, and Greg Anderson is never going to testify. And those, to me, were really haunting words, that it's worse in America to cheat, break the law, use steroids. It's better to not betray someone, to not tell on them. And I think that says a lot about why people, in fact, lie. So let me talk about some of these reasons. These all happened because there were people around them that helped them, that enabled them, that covered up, and that encouraged them either tacitly or overtly. The simple answer, I think, in many cases why very, very wealthy, successful people lie is a simple case of hubris. They think they're going to get away with it. And by the way, have they gotten away with it in the past? You know, can I prove that? No, but I think some of these characters, in fact, had made lying and successfully lying pretty much a way of life. So they were reinforced over the years that this would happen, and they surrounded themselves with people who made sure that they could keep doing it. Obviously, in some cases, the motives are financial. The Fairfield Greenwich people, cooperating with Madoff the way they did, shamelessly agreeing to do what he did, 100% of the firm profits came from Bernie Madoff. If the SEC managed to impugn his operation or shut him down, they were over. Of course, now they are over because he was shut down. But you can imagine there was tremendous pressure on them to lie, even though they knew what the truth was or suspected it or should have. In many cases, you see people are doing it because they say everyone else is doing it. Certainly in the sports world, the Barry Bonds case snared scores of other professional athletes, many of whom told the truth and said, yes, they were using steroids. But in almost every case, they said, well, everybody else is doing it, so why can't I? But the fact is, no, everyone else is not doing it. Everyone who is cheating is doing it, but there are people who are not doing it who are being disadvantaged because of it. There was an extraordinary story that surfaced there involving a track coach named Trevor Graham, who was just shamelessly getting his stars, including Marion Jones, to use steroids. And he got them from a dealer who'd come from Mexico and was in Texas. And he was called before the grand jury and said, did you ever have any dealings with this dealer? He said, no. Have you ever met him? No, never met him in person. Have you ever spoken to him on the telephone? No, we've never talked. Well, the FBI eventually got the drug dealer to cooperate, and they got a photograph of Trevor Graham with the drug dealer meeting in San Antonio. They got phone records from both Trevor Graham and the drug dealer that showed hundreds of telephone calls during the relevant time period. And so Trevor Graham was put on trial for false statements. The jury met, and they heard all the testimony, including from the drug dealer himself. There were 5 other professional athletes who testified that Trevor Graham got them to take drugs and got them from this guy. The jury acquitted him. So the judge afterwards went into the jury room and she said, you know, thank you for your service. It's, you know, it's great to be a juror and we appreciate this. But I have one question for you. How in God's name did you reach that verdict? And there were 11 jurors who all took their finger and pointed at the one holdout who was I was able to interview. And he said, after briefly claiming he thought he was innocent, he said, oh, okay. Let's just, he was guilty, I admit it. But everybody was doing that. I don't think it's fair. He was a family man, and that drug dealer was worse than he was. And you know, he just went off. Completely irrelevant, at least in terms of the law issues. But I think it does show that when somebody thinks everybody is doing it, not only do you have people lying and thinking they're going to get away with it, but you have juries who will not convict even when all the evidence is right in front of them. And finally, I think you see in the Greg Anderson case that the issue of loyalty and friendship is the number one reason that I found people lied to protect other people. This was Scooter Libby with the vice president. This was the stockbroker for Martha Stewart. And this was Greg Anderson for Barry Bonds, a sense of loyalty. But let me just point out one thing. If you betray that sense of loyalty, you can get into trouble. One of my favorite stories in the Martha Stewart case was that line on the terrace where she said to her best friend, isn't it nice to have brokers who tell you things? So this this broker told me, the real estate broker who was her best friend told me, that she wrestled with her conscience for weeks because Martha was her best friend, her dear friend. She loved her like a sister. She didn't want to say anything bad about her, but she knew her civic duty was to tell the truth. Well, I found this little anecdote rather persuasive in this regard. Martha Stewart, despite being a billionaire at the time, after she had this trip, billed the entire cost of it to her publicly traded company as a quote-unquote business expense. And on the form, she wrote, business meeting with Steve Schwartzman, who happens to be the head of a big hedge fund company in New York and who she knows. So I thought, isn't this odd? She'd be having a business meeting the day after Christmas at a Mexican resort. So I called Steve Schwartzman, who I happen to know, and I said, did you and Martha Stewart have a business meeting the day after Christmas? He said, no. He said, well, let me think for a second. He said, you know, we were in the same resort, and I said hello to her when we passed in the lobby. So this was the quote-unquote business expense. But Martha Stewart, who in her defense of this trial claimed she didn't really care about money, and that's why she wouldn't have insider traded, not only billed the company for the $17,000 bill, the trip, but she had her accountant call her best friend, the real estate broker, and say, you have to pay your fair share. In other words, she didn't just get reimbursed once, she got reimbursed twice for the same trip. So this is someone who doesn't care about money. So I was thinking, okay, so now you're Martha Stewart's best friend. You've been on this trip that you thought you were her invited guest and we're not going to have to pay for. And by the way, you don't even have that much money. Suddenly she wants you to pay her fair share. And now you're thinking, now do I do my civic duty or do I protect Martha? Well, guess what? She testified. She told about the line, about isn't it nice to have brokers who tell you things. And when the jurors were polled afterwards, they said the most significant testimony in convicting her was the testimony of the best friend. So be careful, by the way. If you're going to lie and expect loyalty to carry you through, you better be loyal. But one thing that struck me in these loyalty instances, which I think is a really important insight, is the loyalty always only runs in one direction, which is from the weaker, the less wealthy, the less important, to the celebrated, the powerful, the ultra-rich, on whom these people depend. It never goes the other way. Like, why didn't Barry Bonds, who was making $17 million a year at the Giants at the time, why didn't he go forward publicly and say, Greg, you know, my personal trainer, don't go to jail for me. I don't believe I ever took steroids. I don't believe that whatever you did to me constituted taking steroids, but you go before the grand jury and tell the truth, and I'll accept the consequences, because I don't want to see you in jail ruining your family because of me. No, nothing like that. Martha Stewart never came forward. Here's a 26-year-old guy who's been working on Wall Street for 6 weeks, who she calls and gives the order to sell. He's now lying for her. Does she ever come forward and say, don't ruin your life for me? I don't believe I did anything wrong, but you tell the truth. Don't put yourself in harm's way. No, none of these people ever say this. Scooter Libby, before he testified before the grand jury the first time, the first of 9 times in which he lied about how he knew about Valerie Plame, he went into the vice president's office, and there was a witch hunt going on. The press was saying who knew, who in the White House knew about this, And Scooter Libby sat down to the vice president and said, well, I think I know something about this. And the vice president, according to Libby's later testimony, put his hands over his ears. He did not want to hear anything more. He did not say, oh, what is that? Remind me, did I set this in motion? And by the way, go tell the truth, because I don't think there is a crime committed here. No, he put his hands over his ears. This is a dangerous situation. Why do we have these laws? Why do we require people to tell the truth under oath in a court of law? Because whoever defines the facts, whoever decides what the truth is, controls ultimate power. This has been the hallmark of every dictator, every tyrant in world history. They create what is true. George Orwell in The Animal House has the animals ruling over the others, making up the truth on a daily basis. This is a prescription for tyranny. Perjury has been illegal since the Roman Empire, at least, and probably even longer than that, because people have understood throughout here that this is the bedrock of civilization. When Greg Anderson finally got out of jail for the last time, all his fellow prisoners came around and gave him a standing ovation because he had never talked. And I thought to myself, I really think that says it all. This is the code of the prison yard. This is the code of the mafia. This is the code of organized crime. This cannot be the code of a civilized society. What can we do about this? This is a serious problem in this country. I documented any number of examples of it, but there were many, many more I could have written about. And again, to show how nonpartisan I am, I've criticized Vice President Cheney. Do I need to remind you that we had a sitting president of the United States in Bill Clinton who committed perjury, only grudgingly admitted it, and has never apologized for it? And I had law enforcement people of every party at every level, from lowest assistant prosecutors to U.S. attorneys around the country, tell me that that was the most devastating blow towards getting the truth that they have experienced in their lifetimes. And we still have not recovered from that. The solution to me, though, has got to begin with every one of us. We do need more enforcement at the top of the justice system, from the president, from the attorney general, but we cannot have a policeman or an FBI agent or a prosecutor sitting in every time someone is asked in an important situation to tell the truth and then do that. It has to start at home. It has to start with us, and it has to be our setting an example at an early age, as I learned in the second grade at Adams School in Quincy, Illinois. That is fine, better than in much more serious consequences later. But we have to look very carefully at our own conduct and make sure that we're not lying, and perhaps more importantly, that we're not encouraging it or tolerating it or enabling it in others. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for very thought-provoking, eye-opening remarks. Really appreciate it. We're going to get into some questions. We've got some time for some questions. You mentioned the FBI, so let's start with the news of the day, which is the recent revelation of the resignation of CIA Director Petraeus and the implications of that. And one of the things in the press accounts in the last 48 hours is that the FBI was wrestling with whether or not these private lies had public implications. And ultimately, things started to unravel and this information came out. But the question is there a difference between private lying and public lying? And what are those distinctions, or should we not make distinctions?
Well, the law does make distinctions between lies that are actually criminal and laws that give rise to civil liability and lies that are not prosecuted at all. So I think everybody recognizes that there's a wide gradation between the most serious criminal kinds of laws and those that are relatively harmless and, in fact, help lubricate society. But I think when you're talking about someone at this high level, someone who's in charge of the CIA, one of the most sensitive posts in America, somebody who's been a general in the military, somebody who's an extremely important role model, that those lines go away. Whether ethically or in a technical legal sense they do or not, that's a very, very serious problem. And I will say this on his behalf. As far as I can tell, when actually confronted with it, he immediately admitted it. He didn't take the far more common tack, which is, oh, no, it's not true, I didn't do it. By the way, not in my book, but I had an interesting conversation with Elliot Spitzer along these lines, and I after his scandal broke. I said, you know, I have to hand it to you. You at least you admitted it. You didn't, you know, start covering up and lying about it. I said, why did you do that? He didn't want to talk about it. So I don't know the answer. But I do think the underlying question is, well, why would someone in General Petraeus' position have an affair? It's very similar to the question I pose, is why is someone who's so successful and powerful and such a role model, why would they lie? Or why would they commit securities fraud? You know, can fill in any particular crime there. And I don't know the answer, and I'll be fascinated to see the facts as they come out. But I bet the results are going to be somewhat similar. There's a certain amount of hubris when you've been that decorated and you're that acclaimed. You think you're going to get away with it. And I would also bet that he isn't the only person who knew about this, that there you cannot have been in his position without other people knowing about these, the time they spent together, when they were doing things that they said they weren't doing. Mark my words, everything I just talked about is going to emerge in this case sooner or later.
Great, thank you. We have a couple of different questions that we've seen here, including via Twitter. Thank you for those questions. About essentially, what's the greater draw for people who lie? Is it power or money?
I think it's those, and then there's also what I would call a thrill factor that seems to infect certain people at very high levels of performance. There's this idea of like putting one on, over on other people. It gives them a sense of greater omniscience. Bernie Madoff kept saying, you know, he's continued to lie from his prison cell, but he kept saying, oh, I kept hoping I would get caught, and I was living under the burden of this, and I wanted to stop, and, you know, I dismiss all that. Anybody who wants to stop, stops. I think he loved, year after year, you know, getting, the scheme got bigger and bigger, it was even more exciting to him. So there is a sort of thrilling element of that, and some people, they need to kind of reaffirm that they're somehow better than everyone else, and therefore they can get away with it. I think it's even more than that, than just the sheer desire for power and wealth, although that, I think, also fuels this, and they go hand in hand. But a rational calculation, if all you cared about was power and wealth, in my view, would rarely say, yes, you should lie about this. In all the cases I wrote about, either they weren't prosecuted for the underlying behavior, or they weren't found out until their lies were so brazen that it came collapsing down on them. So I don't think it really was rational to tell those lies.
So you mentioned in your remarks the examples from politics, from business, from sports and entertainment. Which ones are the best liars, and why?
Well, I assume that the best liars are the ones we don't know about yet. And I can't say exactly where they were. I was struck at how bad all of these liars really were. The lies, you know, the Martha Stewart example is very clumsy. The Barry Bond lies were terrible. Scooter Libby, you know, Scooter Libby made the classic liar's mistake of not just saying I wasn't the source, but he said, oh, I couldn't have been the source because I learned about it for the first time from Dick Russert, who was the NBC bureau chief, and then the story goes on and on and on. And every element of the story, it's like me adding on the part about the grocery shopping. There are new witnesses, new facts, all of them wrong, that multiply by a huge amount the likelihood of getting caught. So in the end, Scooter Libby testified to the grand jury that he heard about Valerie Plame from Dick Russert, the NBC bureau chief. 9 different employees in the White House testified that they had discussed her with him before he ever talked to Dick Russert. 9 witnesses. No jury is going to acquit on that. So that's bad lying. So they were surprisingly bad. And I think actually, as you move up the ladder, people who are powerful and successful and maybe have gotten away with it in the past are more reckless.
You offered your plea to all of us that we're part of the solution. But how do we create more incentives to tell the truth as opposed to the incentives for lying? And there's several examples where ultimately the liars are revealed. But they can go a long way before they are, Lance Armstrong being the one that obviously came through most clearly in the last year. He succeeded with a series of lies for an extraordinary period of time and got great rewards over an entire professional career. So how do we turn the tables on making the incentive stronger for telling the truth?
Well, I think that's a good question, and it goes to my last comments. I mean, Lance Armstrong is a very interesting example because it's clear that he lied repeatedly under oath on many different occasions, and yet they've recently announced they're not going to prosecute him. And I think it may have been because of their failure in some of the baseball cases and the kind of example I gave involving Trevor Graham, the track star, that it's very hard to get a jury to convict when they think everybody is doing it. And it looks like in the world of bicycle riding, it was a huge problem, and maybe it came close to, in fact, everybody doing it. I don't know if that's why they decided not to do it. But I think this really does start at our level. It has hit home to me many examples where I was told by colleagues, by superiors, by editors of the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, that misconduct, including making false statements to your editor, would absolutely not be tolerated. You'd be fired immediately. And it made a big impression on me. Not that I was seriously tempted not to tell the truth, but not only did I realize this was the culture, but I saw it occasionally when somebody wouldn't be honest, and they were fired. I think these consequences, people shouldn't be embarrassed about this. There's a terrible tendency in corporate America to euphemize or say somebody's resigning because of family reasons to somehow spare them the embarrassment of the real reasons that they're being turned out. Tell us the real reasons. I think the more people know, the better. And they'll see that when there is unethical behavior or illegal behavior, there are real consequences. Again, law enforcement can only do so much. I think the culture that every one of us sets around us plays a very important role. And by the way, I just personally, I don't want to express my support from people I believe to be liars or people who are felons. I don't want to vote for them. I don't want to go to the ballpark and cheer them. I don't want to buy their household products. That may be a small thing, but if everybody reacted that way, there would be consequences.
So we're almost out of time. We've got quite a few questions here that I haven't been able to get to about politics and lying. But let me move to another group that I think people are really interested in, which is you've spent your career doing this kind of work, and several people are interested in who motivated you, who were your role models in terms of being able to do this type of writing, this type of investigative journalism, and who do you see writing today that's doing good work the way you've been doing for such a long period.
Well, thank you. Well, on the broadest level, I grew up in Illinois, as I mentioned, and right across the river from my hometown is Hannibal, Missouri, which is the hometown of Mark Twain. And, of course, one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates was in my hometown. So I grew up with these sort of twin models of Mark Twain and Abraham Lincoln. And I have to say, I can't think of two better. Abraham Lincoln, you know, Honest Abe, the old nickname, but I can't wait to see the new movie. I mean, to me, just one of the great, great, fabulous figures of world history, in part because of his belief in ethics and integrity. And then a fantastic storyteller across the river. And I love to tell stories. So I've been twinly influenced both by people who I think have made a difference by trying to do the right thing and find out things, and then to be able to tell it in a dramatic way. Not just to plug DePauw, that was really reinforced in college because one of my favorite courses was 20th century American literature and the ability of a skillful writer to bring something to life. And I try as a writer, I don't try to preach, you know, in a speech like this, I'll tell you what I think, but I want to create facts. I want to create worlds that the reader can enter into in a dramatic way and then draw their own conclusions and learn something. And I think that in the end is the most powerful kind of writing you do. So those are twin inspirations. Currently, thank God there's lots of great journalism that's going on, but big influences on me have been Joan Didion, who both is a fabulous writer and has, in the nonfiction area, and then I grew up in the Watergate era, so Bob Woodward been able to meet many times, has been an inspiration to me as well.
Please join me in thanking Jim Stewart.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, and Jim, I'm sure President Casey doesn't mind the extra plug for DePauw. So. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Monday, December 3rd at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and is also available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on Tuesday, December 11th, for a presentation from Frank Luntz, political consultant, pollster, and strategist. Information and tickets for next month's event, as well as all of the rest of our exciting season, can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you all very much for coming. Have a wonderful afternoon.
You've been listening to journalist James Stewart, part of the 2012-2013 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Next month at this time, join us for Frank Luntz, political consultant and strategist. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Allseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.